Jeremy is a man who is not on Linuxy. His erotographomania is always DRM-free. Welcome, Bad Voltage. This is episode 20, by the way. Stop snickering, Jono. We're talking about Bad Voltage here. Hey, Stuart, what show are we listening to right now?
We're listening to Bad Voltage, Brian.
Fucking right we are. Jeremy, what show is this?
I do believe it is Bad Voltage.
See, Jono, some Bad Voltage right here. This is episode 20 of Bad Voltage, ladies and gentlemen. 20-0, which means, I don't know what it means. What does it mean, Jono? What's it mean when you hit episode 20?
It means that this is the 20th
show. Damn straight it means this is 20th show. Jono, what are we going to do in the 20th episode of Bad Voltage?
So, we're going to have a quick conversation, and when I mean quick, I mean long and rambly, about Uber and Lyft, which are the people with the pink moustaches, about changing transit and whether that's a good thing and how taxi drivers are responding.
Damn, that's a sexy topic.
We're going to look at the black phone, called by Ars Technica Android for the paranoid. It's an explicitly built phone whose core purpose is privacy.
Yeah.
And then Jono will review the drop cam, and we'll go into a discussion that has nothing to do with the drop cam. We'll discuss nothing about the technical specs or whether you can hook it up to your existing Z-Wave network, but we will discuss privacy.
Oh, that's beautiful. And then that stems right there into poetry competition. Guys, we're going to have a poetry competition. What do we call that poetry competition, Jono?
We call that poetry competition the Bad Voltage Versification. A perversification.
It's a terrible name for a poetry competition. That's just a terrible, terrible name for a poetry competition, but it's a poetry competition, so it's awesome. What else do we have to talk about today?
You know what? You know what's driving the Bad Voltage Versification, perversification? It's the community. Community, a community, a communitar. And we're going to be providing some input and some feedback on the great stuff that's going on in the community. So, I always get abused, by the way, for the segue
that's right.
to Jeremy,
Jeremy
at this point.
I wouldn't really call
Jono.
It a segue.
You're doing it again!
Hold
You're
on.
Making it
Hold
worse!
On. Hold on.
Is this a bad thing?
I need Jono to SDF you right here for a second. I need you to not do a segue.
Okay.
We're not going to do any segue. We're just going to go quiet for a minute.
No
and
segue.
Jeremy gets to say whatever the hell comes to his mind. Everyone shut up. Shut up. Right
And now, Bad Voltage.
He nailed it! Yeah!
Every fucking week, honestly.
A little while ago, we had a fun little competition called The Weakest Geek. And it went down pretty well because it had really kind of very little to do with Linux, and it was pretty funny and hilarious, I think. So, in the interests of producing content that is unfathomable, we have a brand new competition that is called the Bad Voltage Versification Perversification Competition. Now, let me explain this very briefly how this is going to work. It's basically a poetry competition, right? So, I posted a message to the forum last week at community.badvoltage.org and said, we're going to have a poetry competition. Mainly because Brian thinks he's so good at poetry, and we want to show him up.
God damn it!
But here's the thing: the community get to suggest the words, right? So the community went in there and suggested all kinds of words, most of which we can't say.
I was going to say, and
spell.
They did not disappoint.
Right, that we have to use in our poems, and then what we've got to do is we have to use those words in each poem. You know, so if the word is used more than once, we have to use that more than once in the poem. And then we will present the poems on the show. Now, the winner of the poetry competition then gets to choose a community member who made their life particularly difficult and punish them by choosing an image for them to change their avatar forum to. So that's avatar on the forum too. So that's basically how this works. Now, we were saying, you know, obviously, this is a poetry competition. This is a work of literary genius. And we need someone who is going to be able to provide that level of intellect and insight and creative... I'm running out of long words to say, but basically a genius who can come on here and judge this competition fairly. So who better than Leslie Hawthorne from Elasticsearch, formerly of Google and Red Hat and elsewhere. Leslie, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Jono. Also, it's good to know that I have you completely snowed, that I am classy, intelligent, and ingenious. So, woohoo, rock on!
Yeah.
There it is.
You're doing a good job. So, Leslie, you're gonna walk us through this. We're going to go through each person one by one. You're going to mention the words they've got to say. So, over to you.
All right, so let's go ahead and get started with Brian, and I'll go ahead and read out your word list before we listen to your gorgeous poetry. Mm-hmm. And good luck to you, because some of these words I cannot properly pronounce.
Good, me neither.
Chaotophysic, unilinuxy, erotographomania, dono, love, elementary OS, hide, minger, numpty.
Go. God. Here we go. This is a poem that's not about Jono. I swear to God, it's not about Jono. Listen, I'm telling you, it's not about Jono. It's not about Jono. It's not about Jono. It's not about his love for elementary OS. That passion grows deeper with each caress. All through the night, British-y cries of, oh yes, and other weird shit, but I digress. I've got an idea. Let's talk about Stuart. Please, oh dear Lord, let us talk about Stuart and sing of his love for the parallel port, the most numpty minger to be queen consort. Those Scots have a nickname for him indeed. Feckin' limey bastard with a red heed. And his underwear is, naturally, made from fine tweed. I don't know why I wrote that. Probably the weed. What was I talking about? Oh, right, not Jono. Hey, that guy Jeremy, he's also not Jono. Guess what rhymes with Jono? Bono rhymes with Jono. Luckily, this poem is in no way about Jono. Jeremy is a man who is not on Linuxy. His erotographomania is always DRM-free. He watches MTV down in Tennessee while sniffing potpourri. And that's why I screen his caller ID. Oh, geez, I better wrap this poem up quick. Luckily, it's pretty rad, so I think it'll do the trick. Fish, stick, drop kick, sleepy dick. I bet you guys were wondering how I was going to work in steatopygic.
Yay! There we go.
Bang, ring.
So I'm deeply impressed, but I have to point out a fatal flaw here, which is, as we all know from, you know, his long and storied career, it's always all about Jono. So,
always, yeah,
yeah, yeah. That is true. That is true.
Very good.
That was quite good. All right. And I appreciated your use of "stay out of pidgin."
Oh, thank you, thank you. I like that I got the chance to rhyme something with "sleepy dick." So that was a big moment for me.
Career highlight, quite possibly.
Very nice. All right, so Jeremy, you're up next, and here is your word list. Gongoozler, pseudo-perpendicular, autogonostophilia. I'm so glad I don't know what these mean.
You're especially glad on that one.
Answers, dauber, straw mash, and once again, numpty makes a lovely reappearance.
And I'll point out, because Leslie's reading from Jono's list from the forum, that Jono forgot aluminium or aluminum, which I did work in.
Oh, it's totally aluminium.
Yeah.
I actually wrote a verse for both and chose between them, and I ended up going with the aluminum verse, but...
Yeah. Well prepared. Very nice.
Yeah. Take it away, Jeremy.
All right. As I pick up the mic I left on the stage of the community forum, I hope as I get going, the three of you numpties can keep your decorum. Although I live by the Erie Canal terminus, I'm no gongoozler, and I didn't promote the Mars One project because I'm no bamboozler. I'm not sure why Craig Maloney picked the word autogenostophilia, but I'm pretty sure on that one, the Marquis de Sade is the only one who'd feel ya. While it's improbable Stuart has a pseudo-perpendicular dauber that's stramish, I'm happy to say I don't know the answer for sure, lest my cerebral cortex I'd have to demolish. You Brits invented the language, but some of your pronunciations are just dumb. We won the war, we get to decide, so from now on, aluminum. I must concede that in reality, none of my co-presenters can be classified as a numpty. Although, I'll go out on a limb here and guess none of them can dance. Not even the Humpty. Since I used four of my words in a single sentence, I'm out already, but I'll continue my dosage. Because we all know the show doesn't really start until I say, and now, bad voltage.
Yeah!
Yes.
Nice!
There it is!
I am deeply impressed, but I have to ding you for your use of aluminum now that I live across the pond.
It was a tough choice.
Yeah, you suck. You suck, Jeremy.
Dude, way to represent.
Wow. I have to say, I'm not feeling very good about my poem at this point.
I'm not feeling good about pronouncing your word list, so. Okay.
That was very impressive.
Are we ready to head over to Stuart to wax poetic for us?
I can do that.
All right, sir. Your word list is prestidigitation. I feel like I have not done sufficient research. Flossin, nosin, hippolification. My lord, I'm glad I don't know what that is either. Sounds like bird flu. Diaspora. Watermelon-esque. Cocksackle. Humble. Compassionate. Bossack. Scunner. Numpty.
Okay.
Wow us.
Yeah, I don't know what the rest of the words mean either. Right.
I think we're probably in a very good place there.
From minute little acorns, great oak trees might grow. At least that's what we said when we set up this show. To amuse and enlighten, bicker and crack, as a hedge for the day when we all get the sack. And the show's verbal methods, prestidigitation, or perhaps flocky-knocky nihilipilification. That's the action or habit of calling it worthless. Like our podcasting rivals, remarkably mirthless. Because of our secret weapon, our argument lion. The jocks call him a borsack, but I call him Brian. A man with a scunner for equitable fight, even given those times he's unwelcomely right. Mr. Bacon, who had the original idea and is forced into playing our sound engineer. Because the hell with Ubuntu. Incentivized prize. Contribution to beardage or grand larceny of pies. Then there's Jezza, the sole beard among us in fashion and the one in the team with an ounce of compassion. Always ready to seize, opportunity knocks. Grab the low-hanging fruit if he stands on a box. Last, a ginger who thinks over fondly of fondant, the poet of poets, your humble respondent. A wit that's incisive, a manner burlesque, and a figure, alas, rather watermelon-esque. Now, for judging. Which numpty best summoned their powers? Give the garland to them, and then argue for hours over which forum poster will choose as our lackey and who made the worst pun around words like cocksacky. Go tweet it, or Facebook, or Windows Explorer, or what my teammates insist should be called Diaspora, because we don't want this place feeling quiet as a morgue. So come join us, community.badvoltage.org.
Yeah, nice.
That's good. That's good.
Stuart, that was quite lovely, but I just wanted to let you know that John Dunn called, and he would like his acorn oak tree metaphor back.
I know, I'm sorry.
Beautiful verse in the fine English British tradition. All right,
very
Jono,
good.
I am not even going to try to pronounce your first word. Can you pneumono ultra, what on earth?
Pneumono ultra microscopic silico volcano coniosis.
Stuart, you amaze and delight at all times. Well done. Mammoth rept, kale, Brian, taste, mandible, frickle knuckle, and numpty.
Once upon a midnight scale, while I pondered cabbage and kale, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten Brian, while I nodded, actual numpty, suddenly I became all grumpy. As of someone gently firkle-knuckling at my chamber door. 'Tis some mammoth rept, I muttered, tapping at my chamber door. Only this and nothing more. I distinctly remember, it was in bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the new mono ultra microscopic silico volcano calliosis. Motherfuckers. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I'd sought to borrow from my books a cease of sorrow, sorrow for the lost Lenore, drier sheets, for the rare and radiant mandible, from the angel's name Lenore, drier sheets, nameless taste forevermore. Deal with it.
Jono, why are you eating dryer sheets?
I don't know. Also, I don't know what Lenore is. I don't know what Lenore is, but I know it's a brand of dryer
right,
sheets.
Two things. First of all, the Lenore which is stuff for dryers is not Lenore from the Edgar Allan Poe poem. Secondly, Poe has literally just exploded in his grave wherever it is.
With the not eating dryer sheets.
Yeah.
So
I admit that I somewhat inspired that poem from Edgar Allan Poe.
A little bit.
Okay. Judging.
Love it.
So, all right. So the moment of truth, Leslie, you beautiful, insightful woman.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that. Wow, this is a really tough call. I'm deeply torn. We've got Syl with his beautiful, fine English verse tradition. We have Jono, who's braving, you know, the test of imbibing certain laundry chemicals for our edification. Oh, my goodness. And Jeremy with his aluminum, which is true for where he sits. But I think, gentlemen, I'm going to have to go with Brian.
Yay!
Good job, Brian. Oh, that feels good.
I would like to know, sir, just have you already chosen the person that you intend to change their avatar? Or
you know, here's the thing. I have not chosen at this point. I will by the end of the show. I assumed I was going to lose to Jeremy, to be honest with you. I thought that was a foregone conclusion. Yeah. No. This is very important that I win, because then I win. So let's go ahead and stick to that. But whoever I do choose is going to get it. You know what? Actually, whatever the guy was that made me choose Heed, H-E-I-D, whoever it was that suggested that.
That would be Nero.
Nero,
without even checking, I bet you that's Nero.
Because that's the one. That's because he made me have to do a pseudo almost Scottish accent, and that was very hard for me, and he should suffer for that.
Let me check who did he.
Bet you a dollar it was Nero.
It was Nero.
Nero. It's you, man.
So, Brian, before Leslie has to run off, what do you want to change his Nero's avatar?
You could change it to anything you want to. For instance, you might want to change it to an English flag, the flag of St. George or something like that, because he'd love that.
That'd be...
And that's what you get when you pick a bunch of Scots words with the hope of laughing quietly at all of us mispronouncing
them. Now, is Nero a Scottish dude? Is he Scottish?
Yeah, he's Scottish.
Oh, then we're absolutely doing that. Yes, we're absolutely, exactly.
What about the Queen? I mean, the other option is the Queen.
Yes.
Maybe the Queen on a British flag.
What would be more insulting? Just a beautiful picture of the Queen's head or the flag?
That God Save the Queen picture, I say.
All right, Queen. Queen it is.
Yeah.
We're going Queen.
Oh, maybe even one of the little signs saying, say no to independence. Well, that's wow. What happens when you pick a bunch of deliberately Scottish words in order to laugh at us.
We go simple. We're going the Queen. We're going to go the Queen.
I'll find the best picture
and I'll put it up in the forum for him.
Victory.
Right. Excellent. Wonderful. Leslie, thank you so much for joining us to judge the competition.
Thanks, Brian.
And we hope to see you on Bad Voltage at some point again in the future.
Sounds lovely. Yeah, thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Leslie.
Take care, Leslie. Bye.
We've seen the outgrowth of a couple of new companies, a couple of new types of companies, really, Uber and Lyft. The idea here is that ordinary people get to be taxi drivers. And we're trying to get around the idea that...
My dream.
Exactly. You always wanted to be a taxi driver, right? And obviously, from one side of things, the whole idea of Uber is it's shaking up an otherwise moribund industry where you can... The idea behind this, for people who haven't used this, is that you can install the Uber app or the Lyft app on your phone, and then if you're in one of the cities that they support, you can just call them. It's essentially... punch a button in the app and it will summon the nearest car to you, driven by an ordinary person, not necessarily an actual taxi driver. They'll come directly to you. You can pay within the app. You don't need change in your pocket. You don't need to stand on the corner saying to them, "Hell yeah, I'm opposite this kebab shop," or whatever. It's all done with GPS, so on and so forth. It's the sort of technology that you'd hope taxi firms would have invented by themselves, and largely they don't seem to have done so. However, The flip side of this is that actual taxi companies pretty jarred off by this whole concept because they have to go through.
You're not kidding.
You know, I mean, I don't want to overstate the matter here, but if you're an actual taxi driver, you may have spent thousands of dollars on training, on learning, on getting your medallion in cities like New York or
New York. They're more like 100,000
places. Like, yeah,
getting your medallion, really?
That's what it's called. It's called a taxi medallion.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant like an actual proper medallion.
No, it's called a taxi medallion.
He did mean a proper medallion in this case.
Yeah, right. So,
like a hairy chest medallion.
No,
okay.
Not like David Hasselhoff. So you might have spent, as Joey says, $100,000, hundreds of thousands of dollars. If you're in London, you'll have spent 2 years learning the knowledge. And then for some random bloke to rock up in a Ford Escort with an iPhone and a dream and say, hey, I'm just as good as a taxi driver, plus no regulations for me, has jarred off the taxi drivers no end in every city that Uber and Lyft have shown up in. So I'd be interested in your guys' thoughts about, is this genuinely disrupting a moribund market, or is it a bad sign of things to come?
Well, I think it's undisputably disrupting it. Whether it's good or bad, I think is a different question.
In Uber's case,
it's really, Uber really is two completely different companies acting under the same name, right? Because Uber is licensed, you have to be a licensed limousine driver with commercial insurance. So they are licensed commercial drivers if you use Uber. UberX is the one where some bloke in his Prius shows up and, you know.
Yeah,
right. And Lyft is even more bizarre to me, right? Because there's no fare associated with it all. It's a quote-unquote donation, which to me would tend to... I've actually not used Lyft. They are in Buffalo. I've just never used it. But that would mean, if it's a donation, couldn't you ostensibly not pay it at all? Seems like an odd business model. I'm assuming then you would not get picked up by further Lyft drivers. But.
Well, yeah. I mean, presumably this is like that thing where, you know, the IRS or the Inland Revenue come out and say, you have to pay tax on all your wages. And you go, it's not wages. It was a donation.
Right,
so Lyft seems to
a little bit more. No. Plus, I don't want to be driven around in a weird car with a pink mustache. That just freaks me out a little bit.
No? You don't have one of those in your own car?
Well, I have one on my own car. That's not weird. Just someone else's car is where it's
bizarre. I mean, the thing I think's interesting about this is that unusually, and it's difficult to get this out of the media, both sides do have a point here, right? If you're an Uber, a person who likes Uber, you say we're disrupting a moribund industry, blah, blah, blah. But they're right. Cab drivers are useless and work shy and annoying, and they show up late and they charge too much money, and it's really irritating to have to deal with them. Don't get me wrong. This is all completely true. And when Uber people say that and people who like Uber say that, I agree with them. Equally, I've now used Uber twice, and both times it's been a complete disaster.
Really? That's the exact opposite experience I've had.
Right. I mean, the whole magic GPS thing that I was describing, where you just say that and then your phone does it. John, I will tell you. We were a fate thing, and we decided to get an Uber car back. We ended up spending 20 minutes on the phone saying, no, we're next to the fate. And the person driving it had no idea where they should have been summoned there by GPS. That didn't work. And when we described where we were in the town, they had no idea because they're not taxi driver. An actual taxi driver, if you say we're near to the fate, they'll know what they're talking about because it's their job to understand.
I cannot tell you how many times I've gotten to a taxi, said a very obvious place, and they had no idea what I was talking about.
Right. This is why in London you have to study the knowledge for 2 years. Right. I admit London may be better than everywhere else.
In this particular case, I wouldn't disagree. Because anytime I've been in a cab in London, it has been a better experience than most cities. But part of the thing with cabs is the amount of fraud in the taxi industry reached a level where it really bothers people, I think, from taking very indirect routes to just straight up mischarging people to not showing up to showing up late. I mean, I've used Uber twice and UberX quite a few times, and I've had nothing but a good experience.
Yeah, I mean, the issue that we had with Uber was that, you know, when you request the ride, it finds your GPS location. And what actually happened is that the pinpoint where it was not where we were exactly stood. But to Ak's point, the guy didn't have the knowledge, right? So he didn't know how to find us, which is a problem. But to your point, Jeremy, like a lot of other taxi drivers don't know where the hell they're going as well.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the major thing here is that the thing I like about this whole Uber Lyft thing is that people are innovating in terms of transit, right? And I think we need that because taxi drivers, to me, the whole taxi kind of industry is tired and it's stuck in its ways from the perspective of a consumer. I don't know all the details in terms of regulation and all the complexities that are involved in becoming a taxi driver. But they, the taxi world just doesn't seem to have innovated. And Uber have come out with something new that's convenient for the user. And that's the reason why Uber's interesting, is that it's super convenient. I can see where the car's going to be, right? Because it's like, you know, you're going to go have dinner with some friends at 7:30. You book a taxi 15 minutes beforehand, and then it turns out that you can't get a taxi for 40 minutes. All right, that's typically the way it works. Whereas with Uber, you have a better idea of that. The problem with it, in my mind, is that the people who are suffering with this are not the taxi companies, it's the taxi drivers. And I've never got into a taxi once and a taxi driver has not complained about there being too many drivers on the road and, you know, the business is slow and all the rest of it. So the thing that I don't like about this is that the way a lot of the traditional taxi world is fighting back is through legislation as opposed to competition, which to me seems like a
That's
the new American way, though, right?
I understand what you're saying there, yes, but equally, the reason they're trying to fight back about legislation is because, as I mentioned, if you want to be a taxi driver in New York, it costs you $100,000 to get a medallion, right? An Uber person goes, well, we're not a taxi driver because there's no meter in the car, so we don't have to pay $100,000. And if you're a taxi driver, you're like, what? That's completely unfair. I had to go massively into debt to do this. Even if I compete, it's not going to help because you've still got $100,000 to spend on stuff that I haven't. I think, yes, to some extent, there are taxi drivers who just dislike the idea of competition and are fighting back on those grounds. But I think a lot of them see it as unfair that Uber have basically done an end run around the law by getting to say, hey, look, we're innovating, use us instead of taxis, but avoid all the restrictions that are put on taxis. And taxi drivers don't make up restrictions. They're put there by the government for a good reason.
Right. But it seems like what's going to happen, I suspect, is that Uber's not going to go away. What's going to happen is that there will be a set of restrictions placed upon Uber drivers.
Which look the same as taxi. At that point, I'd be absolutely fine with it. Any taxi driver who then complains, you say, well, then compete. And you should be doing things like showing people on their iPhone when the cab's going to show up. But they should have been doing that 10 years ago, and they haven't done it. Right. And you're completely right.
Yeah. But if cabs are complaining there's too many cabs, why does it take 40 minutes to get a cab in your case?
Because cab drivers suck. See, here's the problem. And so everything you guys have all said so far is right. Cab drivers generally suck. Cab drivers shouldn't have to be extorted out of $100,000 in 2 years of their lives just to give you a Lyft down to the train station. That's ridiculous. That said, Lyft and all these other companies shouldn't be, you know, skirting around legislation and rules just to try and make a quick buck, which is kind of what they're doing in a way. Yeah. But what really scares me about all of this is when you start combining what the things like Uber and Lyft are doing, where you can pull up a phone and GPS pinpoint yourself and have a car come pick you up, with things like maybe a Google self-driving car, you end up in a situation where not too far in the dystopian future, you're going to pull up your iPhone, it's going to crash four times, you're going to hit a button, a car's going to show up a block away, you're going to have to hoof it in the rain over to the car, the car's got no driver in it, you get into it, and it drops you off at the wrong place across town. When you try to get out, it won't let you out because it keeps saying in a robotic voice over and over again to please insert exact change into the slot. It's going to be a horrible, horrible moment. And basically everything is going to suck a whole bunch. That really, if the taxi drivers want to do something good for themselves, they need to start boycotting Google and self-driving cars to keep themselves from getting put out of a job.
Alternatively, what's going to happen in this dystopian future is that you're going to order your cab, right? A driverless car is going to show up right outside your house. You'll get into it and it'll get to your destination with no issue whatsoever. And, you know, your bitcoins have already come out of your account, right? So that's the way it's going to do. What up? You're a freaking buzzkill, Lundu, right? The future's going to be amazing.
When has that ever borne out to be the case? We want flying cars. We don't get flying cars. We get crappy non-flying cars.
The future is never as awesome as we think it's going to be. Here are two important things about that little statement, Brian Lundig. The first one is, you say, when's it going to get awesome? You're aware we're on different continents talking to one another in real time and making a radio show, right? And secondly, and most importantly, you're about the same age as I am. You were not promised flying cars by science fiction. Your parents were. What you were promised was a horrible William Gibson dystopia. And look out the window, and there it is.
That's a good point. Also, it is coming true.
We live in a world today, Brian, in which you, with your mockery of skills is able to find suitable employment and not live on the streets. What, as well.
Whatever, right, dude.
So which
among us is a winner of poetry competitions on tech-centric podcasts? Which of us four can say that right now?
Is that going up on your resume?
Complete side note, I would like to point out that when we do hold a competition here on Bad Voltage, it is currently a tradition that Brian wins. I just would like to point that out right now. This is a thing that we're doing.
Right, so okay, go ahead, Brian. As your reward, Brian Lunduke, for winning all the competitions so far, and I have to say you have won 100% of competitions, which is rather depressing. 100%. Your reward is now everywhere you have to go for the next 2 weeks, you have to take an Uber car driven by someone who's got no idea what they're talking about and the battery's in their
iPhone. There's no way in hell I'm doing that, man. I'm not even going to lie and tell you I'm doing that. I'm just not going to do it.
So am I the only one that continually had a good experience with these services?
I think so.
That's a result.
I've only had one bad experience on Uber. I've, with the exception of the first time with Ack, Uber's been great for me every other time. I think it's not so much Uber. I think Uber just doesn't like Ack.
Right.
Fair.
In my mind, that's a perfectly good reason for me to not like it.
So what you're saying is Uber can actually activate the camera on your phone, see who you are, and go, no, not in my Prius.
That's a ginger. Delay 20 minutes.
All right. So anyway, enough of this. What do you folks think in the community? Go to community.badvoltage.org and share your thoughts. Do you think Uber and Lyft are good things? What do you think about the idea of taxi companies fighting back in terms of legislation? Where do you think we're going to be in 2 or 3 years? Do you think Uber and Lyft will be legislated, or do you think we'll have Brian's dystopian future with non-flying cars that show up late and drop you off in unusual neighborhoods with criminals and rapists?
Criminals and rapists, guys.
They're different, obviously. Go to community.badvoltage.org.
Days of reality TV shows and jazz cigarettes, the world has become filled with uncertainty. We live in uncertain times, on uncertain streets, and are surrounded by uncertain people. Invariably, the cure for said uncertainty is information. If we can see it, reassurance flows through our veins. This applies to lots of things. Hear a bump in the night, not sure if there are undesirables hanging around your office, worried that granddad's house is haunted, concerned that your nanny wants to sell your baby to Cinnabon for delicious experimentation. Well, one solution to these and many other complex life situations is the Dropcam. Put simple, the Dropcam is a webcam that is constantly uploading video to the cloud. It streams the video live, and then you can use the Dropcam website or apps to review video from the last week or month to check in on those undesirable things that may have happened while you weren't looking. The device itself is tremendously well made. It feels rugged and durable, and it's powered by the included micro USB cable and plug. And the Pro model's got one of those wide fisheye type lenses. The regular model's got a normal lens. The camera streams in full HD, has a built-in mic and Wi-Fi, and also has night vision, which is surprisingly clear and detailed. Setup is simple. You plug your camera into a Windows or Mac computer, sadly, no Linux support, you naughty Dropcam people, and connect it to your wireless network and you're done. The Dropcam software interface for looking at your footage is also simple. Available as a Flash-powered website or Android and iOS apps, you can see the live feed and a timeline at the bottom that shows you when motion was detected. This provides a neat way of seeing when motion occurred at surprising times, such as in the middle of the night, as well as to jump into specific times during the day or the evening. The Dropcam also has a nice set of configuration settings. You can set which days and times it records, whether it emails you when it detects motion, provide additional users to access the footage, and even configure whether the little blue recording light's on or not. Overall, the Dropcam is excellent. The device is rugged and well-made. Setup is devilishly simple. It comes with everything you need, and even the packaging and included instructions are beautiful. It feels like a really high-quality package. While a stunning product in operation, the major downside with the Dropcam is that for the device to be truly useful, you need the cloud recording feature, which lets you spin back over the last week or last month's worth of video. Now, this is a paid addition. The camera itself is not particularly cheap at $150 for the regular version and $200 for the Pro model, and the additional fee ratchets the cost up to
to about $100 a year for looking back over a week of footage, or $300 a year for looking back over a month of footage. You then need to factor in that you need a pretty beefy net connection to have the Dropcam and other things on your network running, such as Netflix, consoles, and video calls. Overall, though, for home and office surveillance, watching babies, nannies, and pets, and other uses, the Dropcam is fantastic in product and execution. So what is the bad voltage verdict? While on the pricey side, you get what you pay for with a Dropcam: a high-quality, flawless video streaming solution that is reliable and simple to use.
That sounds terrible. I hate everything about
that. It really does, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sounds just awful. Like if I'm thinking about it from two different points of view, one, I'm thinking about it from the price point of view. If I want that sort of a system, I can easily put together a webcam similar system with more features that cost me less money upfront and over time, that backs up larger sets of data to my servers in the cloud over in some server in Russia or something.
You can.
No, you're not the average consumer.
Yes, you can.
I could not also, aimed at you or any of us.
I could also build a car if I wanted to.
Nah,
if I was a
hang
car
on, hang on, bear with me. I agree with you that, you know, they've got the kind of slick thing set up, but it has to be plugged into a computer. It can't work standalone, right? So no, why is it not just...
No, it does work standalone.
It works standalone.
No, hang on. You plug it into a computer to just get it set up.
In the Pro, you don't even need a computer to set it up.
Yeah. Linksys has a series of kind of Wi-Fi webcams that are similar in this regard. They don't need to be plugged into anything. You can set them up from a Linux-based machine because they basically act like, you know, you just go to the IP address of the individual camera and set it up through a web interface. So it shoots over at that that point. It takes and you can point it at your own servers. You can have the images and the videos uploaded to your own servers, and it's cheaper than the Dropcam. So really, from a product standpoint, not only is it less feature filled, but it's more expensive. So it's restrictive.
But hang on, does the Linksys thing have the cloud video thing where you can go and look at all of the footage for the last
It doesn't
month?
Have like a UI for it, but it timestamps things. So you can look through it.
Right.
So you can look through stuff.
Because that's the key thing. So For example, with the Dropcam, you can scrub through the video. Like, you can drag through it, so you can see when there's motion.
I think the Dropcam is going for the segment. The one thing that I kind of don't like about Dropcam now is that it's Google, right? Because Nest bought them. A little bit leery. But I think the demographic that they were going for was that this is a very high-end, for this consumer market, very high-end device that is... As you said, devilishly simple to set up. That is really, they were going for your mom or whatever could buy it, set it up, and not have to call you. Where the other,
and to be
the
honest,
solution Brian's talking about is a better solution, but one that requires setting
You've
up manually,
make it all
where
up.
This just
yeah.
happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And to be honest with you, $200 is not that much money, to be honest with you. Really. My
That's
big
true.
Objection to it, I was under the impression that it had to stay plugged into a computer at all times, at which point you then just say, why is it not a webcam? Which just saves stuff in your Dropbox folder. But if it works...
Yeah,
right.
It doesn't
it
actually do anything when it's hooked up to your computer.
Yeah, I mean, if it works independently, it uploads all the stuff, and then you've got a nice, convenient UI, which is what you want this for, it doesn't seem that expensive to me, so...
It's
not
still
a
terrible
idea.
I'm a terrible idea. An absolutely
Why is it
horrendous
idea.
Because you're not providing yourself with additional security. What you're doing is you're trading off what sort of security you have. You're saying, okay, I want to be able to monitor my room. In exchange for that, I'm going to place all of the information about what is happening and being monitored in my room on a third-party server that I do not control. Now there's two issues.
To be honest with you, no one. I think that
have
most
you
people
ever used
a
debit card at Target?
Right. Yes, but I would
Stuff
argue that
gets broken
I would argue
into.
That, hang on a second. I would argue that a stream of my living room, when you know at night when I'm not around, right? Basically, it's basically a photograph of my living room because nothing's happening in there, right? That I don't give a shit if that's on somebody else's server, right? Credit card details, that's a little different, right? I get the whole privacy thing, and you know, they encrypt all the traffic that goes over it and all the rest of it, right? And yes, but fundamentally, the video is on somebody else's server. But I don't really see that as that big of a deal. Like, what are they going to do? I mean, if you leave it on all of the time and people can listen to conversations, maybe.
A few bits of information,
it's
a certain amount of responsibility. A few thoughts to think about. One, Someone now knows when you are or when you're not at home. Two, someone can now subpoena.
If they hack into the Dropbox server.
Hack into it or subpoena it, which that sort of data has been given over already. So to agencies.
I agree.
It has.
Criminals probably shouldn't install a Dropcam,
well,
right?
It's not, and it's not just for criminals. Let's say you are having a civil lawsuit with a company. They are looking for information against you. A subpoena goes to the company. If the company can't or doesn't have the means to fight that subpoena on your behalf out of their own pocket, you lose that information and you just gave it up to someone who is suing you. You are giving your information freely. You're giving a live stream of your information freely over to a third-party for-profit company that must abide by the laws of the jurisdiction in which they reside, which is a huge, huge problem.
That's the thing. It isn't a huge problem.
It is.
It's actually a very tiny problem. No, it isn't. It is a perceived huge problem just because it puts data on another on
it's a
server.
Huge problem.
I think there's some people out there who think to themselves, you know what? If there is any of my data on any other server, it's a huge problem. In reality, it's not a huge problem. The likelihood of you getting subpoenaed, the likelihood of somebody hacking their servers is extremely unlikely. I could understand it if you're a criminal and you're using a drop cam to keep an eye on your meth lab. Probably not such a good
not
idea.
A good idea.
I don't think we should overblow the problem.
No, bear me. I mean, I can see Brian's point, but I don't want to push it too hard. But there is a reasonable thing here. I mean, take as an example, eBay lost all the passwords and everyone had to go and reset their password. If someone gets my eBay password, that's a problem. Don't get me wrong, it is. It's tied up to my PayPal account and they can easily go and spend the £8.20 I've got in PayPal at the moment. If someone manages to guess my password for dropcam.com, they can then see when I'm in the house or not. That's rather worrying.
That's incredibly worrying.
I agree.
And you know what?
I'm not saying
and
that...
And Stuart, ahead, you live in England right now. England loves the shit out of cameras. I guarantee you, if they can, they would very much like to have access to that if it might suit their needs at some point. America's just the same way. So it's not a good idea.
But in my mind, what you're doing is you're basically... I'm not denying for a second that there are privacy implications with any service that puts stuff that you own or images of you on another server, right? Right? I'm not denying that for a second. But I just think that first of all, the likelihood of there being issues with you, Brian, or like a regular person, are so small, they're so unlikely and so minuscule. I don't think it's accurate to call it a major problem. I think what it is...
I think
is,
the first time they get hacked and a bunch of pictures of naked people's wives get posted, you might end up feeling differently.
Yep.
Right, and I'm...
Or me and my enormous schlong. I do not want the internet saying how big my schlong is. It's going to make me feel self-conscious when I walk around and I'm not going to like that.
But that's because you're steatopygic, right?
And for the show, it's dauber, not schlong.
So here's kind of the...
But I'm assuming... Go ahead.
No, go ahead, John.
No, go ahead.
I cannot imagine there's anything either of you are going to say to get each other to agree because you seem pretty far apart.
See, that's kind of where I'm at. But here's the thing. None of the four of us are any bad guys running meth labs. We're not human trafficking, at least not that I know of. Jeremy looks kind of sketchy sometimes. But I don't think any of us are doing anything all that bad. But yet, all four of us, do all of us go to Linux Journals Forum sometimes? Do we get technically classified as an extremist by the NSA? Yes. Now, if we're under a situation where a number of different issues get compiled together, the possibility of getting surveilled becomes much, much higher. Don't add opportunity to that mix. Don't willingly say, here's a webcam that potentially is going to look at me naked as I'm walking past. I have this Xbox over here with a camera that has already seen me naked. In fact, it only recognizes me with my pants
Xbox
off.
Xbox on.
And that's, and you know what? That's a problem. That's an issue, and that's something that's not a good thing. I shouldn't be adding additional things to that mix. It's just not a good idea.
But the thing is that there is no doubt that, you know, if we look at history, right, the Industrial Revolution was a major change in history, right? And the information and communications revolution that happened with the internet was a major change in history. There is no doubt in my mind that privacy is the next major battle, right? I think we'd all probably agree with that in moving forward. But I think there is a big difference between being thoughtful and responsible with privacy and being paranoid about every possible system that could potentially inhibit a privacy risk. Because if you go down that route, you become a hermit, right? And I agree with you that there are, I'm not denying that there are privacy risks with the drop cam. There is no doubt about that. They will get hacked at some point. Someone's naked pictures will appear on the internet.
It will be mine, and my wiener's huge.
If you take that risk, then Brian, I'm sure that you today.
I'm not sure I would win against Robin in a murder trial.
I mean, you use a number of Google services right now that have that risk. If you have, if you believe this is a major risk, then you shouldn't use those services.
Dude, you're not entirely.
You got to practice.
You're not entirely wrong, but again, what you're saying is you're attributing the concept of not putting a webcam on yourself 24/7 that's accessible to third parties as being an extremist position. Really, I'm looking at this as, you know what, you mitigate it, you be responsible about it, and putting a webcam on yourself that's available all the time, that is kind of a crazy step. It's kind of like going into your bathroom and saying, you know what, I have way too much privacy when I'm taking a dump. I'm removing all of the walls and doors, and I'm going to make sure that when I take a dump, every neighbor is watching me. That's kind of what we're talking about here.
I would argue that a webcam that's on at night that you can keep an eye on your house when you're not there.
It's not on just at night.
I would argue that the risk to you in that scenario is lower than the risk of you having all of your email on Google servers. And your calendar on Google.
But see, I don't keep all of my email on Google services, though. I have kind of like it's kind of my goofball email.
Attempting to strike a middle ground here slightly. I can see both sides' points of view. I mean, I would have liked to have seen a firm like Dropcam putting together something like the Dropcam, which provides that same beautiful sense of ease of use and quality of build, but also just works inside your house and doesn't need the cloud stuff. It would be nice if if there was a product which suited both Jono's needs and Brian's, rather than you have
there
to,
are a couple.
Rather than you have to choose
Dropcam.
Between.
I think Dropcam's business model, though, is they want that $300 a month.
Yeah,
or a year, sorry.
But then you could argue, you could take the logic to the next level and say, what if someone breaks into your house? I mean, you know, the I believe that the risk is lower, but the risk is still there. And I think to your point, Brian, is it's not really about the thing. It's more about mitigating risk.
Exactly.
And if the risk is there, then arguably it can be abused. The difficulty with these services is that it can be attacked from a number of different destinations. Right? It could be attacked from anyone on the internet. Whereas, you know, the likelihood of Brian flying over to, you know, to Walnut Creek and breaking into my house to steal something is very unlikely because of the travel distance apart from it.
Yet, it's a risk.
It's a risk. You know what? This review turned into an interesting discussion about privacy, and I think this is a great thing for our community to weigh in on. I suspect this could become one of those threads on the Bad Voltage forum that goes on for years. Go to community.badvoltage.org. What do you think? Do you think Brian's right? Do you think that this is something we should kind of discourage? And that there is, you know, we shouldn't open ourselves up to attack vectors with our privacy? Or do you agree with me? Think that it's not as much of a big deal, but we should be responsible about it. Go to community.badvoltage.org and share your thoughts.
So having discussed the Dropcam, a camera which takes video of your house and uploads it to the cloud where anyone can see it, I thought it'd be interesting to talk about technology actually deliberately aimed at the other end of the market. Recently, a company put out a thing called the Black Phone. This is a mobile phone deliberately designed and engineered to put privacy above everything. Now, we've talked in the past about how privacy is important. Jono mentioned in the earlier discussion that privacy is going to be the next big battle. But we haven't seen very much in the way of products aimed at that market, but with a consumer sensibility. You've always been able to maintain privacy, as Brian said. Why would I buy this beautiful, slick device when instead I could buy a webcam myself and then set up a server myself and then rsync things in between the two, right?
Oh, yeah.
And clearly, to ask the question is to answer it. But the idea of the black phone is exactly that you get something which feels and works as slickly and well as an ordinary mobile phone, but has privacy baked into the core of it. What do you guys think?
Brian, do you want to kick off?
I think it's...
Because I think you've probably got more...
So...
You probably associate yourself more with the black phone.
I've considered getting a black phone strongly. I haven't yet. See, I don't actually have a cell phone. And one of the many, many reasons I don't have a cell phone is for privacy-related issues. That said, I still end up using a lot of the many services that cell phones offer, like text messaging and whatnot, through a variety of different channels. But... when I look at the black phone, it does go a certain distance towards securing privacy, but you still really can't secure it completely. And as Jono kind of pointed out the last time, you're really mitigating risk. So the black phone is not a black phone device. It's not something that the spy would use and say, okay, all my channels are mega encrypted and no one can possibly eavesdrop on me. It's just a little bit harder than before. And that is nice to a certain degree. I do like that. And I do really appreciate that.
I think I disagree with that, actually. If the phone and the SMS stuff, there's a company called Silent Circle who provide an end-to-end encrypted zero knowledge channel for phone calls, for text messages, for chat, so on and so forth. And right. I mean, Phil Zimmerman founded the company, the guy who founded PGP, right? Not PHP, PGP. So guy knows what he's talking about.
Also the opposite of security.
Right, yeah, exactly. Right. But that came, and that's the phone and SMS thing they have built in. Now, as I understand it, that's useful if you're talking to other Silent Circle users, so other people on the black phone, other people are using that service anyway. It obviously doesn't secure your SMSs if you just send them to me with my iPhone.
Exactly.
Or whatever. But if what you mean by is just having a phone on one end of the connection does not ensure that the person on the other end with an ordinary phone...
Exactly. You're not going to be able to call up your mom or your girlfriend and have a suddenly secure connection. It's just it's a little bit better. Maybe you can feel a little more secure that maybe the firmware in the baseband is a little more secure on the phone, those sorts of things. But the reality is it's not all the way there, but it's still a really good step.
But I think the thing with the black phone... go ahead.
No, go ahead, Jeremy.
Oh, I was going to say, with the baseband, I think, is still an issue on the black phone, right? Because that's completely non-free software with an enormous attack surface and access to really anything on the phone.
I thought that was one of the points of the black phone.
No, they've done a lot of work on the operating system and the software and everything, but at the firmware level, bear in mind that what they're concerned about is privacy. Open source... using open source software is an epiphenomenon here. Obviously, in general, it's easier to demonstrate this thing maintains your privacy if you can say, because here is the source for it, inspect it yourself. But their point is not to be an open source phone. Their point is to ensure privacy. If doing that with commercial or closed source products is the best way to do it, that's what they're going to do. So
but even beyond the baseband,
non-free phone, right,
even if they plug that enormous hole, then you get into the SIM card, which really is another processor that they have zero control over. I mean, there's so many layers to how cell phones actually work that creating a truly secure one. The other thing I think is weird about the black phone, right, is there is a spy phone already being made by Boeing called the black phone.
Yeah.
So I found it was a really, really weird name, very confusing name to use, because that name's been used by Boeing for quite some time. And that's the one with two SIMs, and one can only do classified networks and one can do unclassified. Why they would take a name already in use for a private phone is supremely bizarre to me.
It's a good thing.
One of the things that I thought was interesting about that is I originally thought that this was being marketed to, you know, Brian and all of his tinfoil hat internet lunatics. But actually, the company who make it are near Washington, D.C. You do get the impression that what they see as one of their big potential sources of income is corporates and government and so on and so forth. It's not just for people who spend their whole time railing against people for using Gmail. It's companies who would say, we have a legitimate commercial reason.
I think there is actually a phone specifically targeted at Brian, and I'm surprised that he hasn't brought it up yet, actually. Because the indie phone seems right up your neighborhood. That seems right in your wheelhouse. I mean, their tagline is empowering people to own their own data. Sounds like you wrote it.
And IndiePhone is a really interesting thing. And Aral, who's doing it, Aral Balkan, is an interesting guy. We should talk about that on another show.
That's a whole different deal. Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing that I think is interesting about the Black Phone, I'm by no means in any way, shape, or form an expert on privacy or even close to it. But the thing that I think is, but I'm sure everyone's surprised.
But you are not the customer here, Bacodio, I've got to tell you.
Yeah. The thing that I struggle with in understanding this, in trying to gain a viewpoint on this, is, and I think this gets to Jeremy's point about the different layers of security that are involved in a cell phone, but even more widely, they're involved in building secure systems, right? And we kind of touched on this a little bit in the Dropcam segment, but, you know, I remember when I read this excellent book about Kevin Mitnick when he was, you know, when he was wanted by the feds and he was basically hacking systems just for fun and to figure out how they work. And one of the primary tools that he used for hacking was social engineering. It was calling people up and pretending to be somebody else, right? It wasn't actually, you know, some incredibly powerful piece of software that you could use to kind of get into these systems. So it seems to me that you can build privacy in at certain layers. You could have a more secure baseband. You could have a more secure operating system. Maybe you could have a more secure way of managing phone calls and SMSs and things like that. But at some point, you're going to hit a wall between when you can connect to the outside world, which is the major benefit of a cell phone, is that you can call people, right? But also, it seems to me, and this is where I struggle, is that you build security in at different levels, but there's always going to be something that you can ultimately do to bypass that level. And that's the reason why I've generally had the viewpoint that you should build security based upon risk, right? You assess the level of risk that you've got, which is going to be very personal to you, right? The risk associated with me using a cell phone is going to be vastly different to the risk associated with a high-ranking official or politician using a cell phone. So it seems to me like the Black Phone is more of a... without being too discriminatory, it seems to be more about vanity and a kind of cosmetic essence of security than real security.
I think you're looking at the thing in the wrong kind of way. In my opinion, I assume we would all agree that if you could just click your fingers and just change the world so it all looked like it was now, but all SMSs were basically end-to-end encrypted by default, and all emails were end-to-end encrypted by default. It didn't change anything, but you could just make that happen. Everyone would go, well, that's a good idea, right? I mean, the NSA might not, GCHQ might not, but we would all think, yeah, that's generally a good idea.
Yeah.
So, to my mind, the Black Phone is a demonstration of the fact that if the world looked like this, basically nothing would change, but everything would be secure. It's like, think of it as the first move. Because if you talk to people and say, well, why isn't the world like that? They say, oh, because it's all really difficult and super techie and ridiculous. And no one could possibly encrypt all their emails because it's impossibly hard to do. If you could then say, look, if everyone had a Black Phone, or everyone had phones like the Black Phone, if phones were built in the way the Black Phone is built, it would be secure. I see it as being like Google Glasses. It's not meant to be necessarily an example of the finished product that everyone will be using. It's a way of demonstrating this sort of thing. You know what? It's possible. Why don't we try and work more with this?
Yeah, but that's the thing I'm saying is that I agree with you. I think it's a stepping stone. The Black Phone is kind of a work in progress for a wider thing. My theory here is that at some point in the next 5 years, like the privacy will be a major feature in most consumer devices, and it will have gone through that, you know, like everything starts out super technical for the early enthusiasts and then it becomes like a consumer product. I think that will happen because privacy is going to be a major
thing. And what's
thing.
Interesting about that is that that's where the next industry industry disruptor comes from, because it's not going to be any of the current players, because Google aren't interested in building in privacy, Facebook aren't interested in building in privacy, right?
So it'll be a smaller upstart.
It becomes a differentiator, and then 10 years from now, a company you've never heard of is in a position that Google or Facebook or Apple are in now, and that'll be because they took privacy seriously and managed to message that to everybody in a way that made people make sense to say, well, yeah, of course I'd want that. They put themselves on the other side of that wall.
And the Black Phone is the
first stepping stone towards someone saying, look, we've made a product that you can actually give to real people. It's not something where you have to set up PHP by compiling on your Linux box.
But that's where I struggle with it a little bit, is that when I hear people participating in these discussions, invariably it's a, for want of a better word, it's a no compromise approach to privacy, right? Like we can't, you know, to the point of the discussion earlier on about the drop cam, right? If we're worried about the idea of uploading video to a website and that could be compromised, which I would argue is a relatively low risk thing, but it is still definitely a risk, right? We have to take an approach. We have to provide consistency across everything, right? And that's where I don't understand this, is that I believe that at every single layer, there will always be a means of compromising systems.
But that doesn't mean you should improve every layer when you can, though. Just because one layer might at some point be subverted.
Defense in depth. Yeah, but you've got locks on your front door.
Mitigate every attack vector you can.
Yeah.
Right, but that's where I struggle with it, because that's my view, is that what we do is we mitigate as much risk as we can. But then ultimately, what worries me about this is that I think the proponents of this new technology are taking a largely no compromise approach. Now maybe this is the difference between kind of like most Linux users and Free Software Foundation people. You know, maybe they're designed to kind of push the middle ground in the right direction.
Well, it seems to me like Blackphone is going towards the middle ground, because they're admitting that you need to go off the secure network, and that's by default enabled. They're allowing you to install the Amazon App Store.
Good point.
So I would say they struck a pretty good balance between being secure enough for most people, but being usable enough for most people.
Yeah, to be honest, if the Black Phone was a mega hardcore device that I could make a call with, and it was a scrambled number and no one could ever trace me, and my voice was all garbled on the other end and sounded like, "You have 5 minutes to live," I would buy one, and I would think that was the most awesome thing ever. But they're not all that hardcore. It's just kind of, it's a good first step, just like Stuart was saying. It's a good move in the right direction.
Yeah. I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to change where the baseline is, right? They'd like to say, at the moment, the baseline is everything is open, and you, by default, you buy a phone, whichever company you bought it off gets to read everything you do on it. We'd like to change the baseline so it's not like that. And then if you want to progressively open bits up, that's fine with us, right? Not a problem. They just want to change where the baseline is.
What's fascinating to me is that with those previous revolutions that we talked about, like the Industrial Revolution and the Communications Revolution, I think to a broad extent, you could kind of get an idea, people at the time could broadly get an idea of where things were going, because it was about going bigger and faster and more efficient in many ways. Now, obviously, I wasn't around for the Industrial Revolution, but I was around for the Communications Revolution, and you could broadly see that things were going to get more dynamic and networks were going to get fast and all the rest of it. With the whole privacy thing, I have no idea how this is going to
I think
out.
You are overestimating how clear it looks while you're inside it. If you went back and talked to Thomas Newcomen or James Watt or someone putting together a steam engine, I doubt that he'd have been able to predict Henry Ford, as an example. From our point of view, it's almost saying that.
What I'm saying is that I think that it was a bit more predictable. I mean, again, I'm looking at primarily the communications revolution that we've had.
Even with that, like, one, I think it's still more retrospect talking than at the time. I mean, it went in directions you wouldn't have thought at the time, I think.
But I'm not saying that it didn't. I'm just saying that, like, even back in the mid-90s, like, it was quite clear that more and more things were going to move to the web. Commerce was going to go there. It was going to be accessible to more and more people. People would end up working on there. That was a bit more obvious. What I'm saying right now is, with this privacy thing moving forward, I have zero idea what's going to happen. I don't know how the challenge of privacy across all of these different services is going to be converted into consumer products that people can use.
What I love is the fact that there are people attempting to make that happen from what I might loosely define as our side of the fence rather than the other side. So you've got the Indie Phone, which is mentioned earlier. You've got the Black Phone people who are attempting to build something which demonstrate how the world might be different.
We should get someone on the show from Black Phone or from one of these products. It'd be fascinating to talk to them about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now we move on to what is still one of my favorite segments of the show, despite the fact that the community gave us some absolutely ridiculous words for that poetry contest from earlier. But we still love you guys, and so now on to the community's segment of this show. But before we get to that, I would like to thank A2 Hosting. For those of you who participate in the community at community.badvoltage.org, you may know, and we had him on earlier, that we run Discourse. as the forum software. And we were on kind of an old distribution of Discourse, and they've moved future development kind of to a Docker instance. And the A2 hosting setup that we had did not support Docker. And when we kind of made them aware that we wanted to switch, they immediately just upgraded and gave us a better... I think they moved us to the cloud VPS. So as John has mentioned in the past, they don't ask for us to say anything about them on the show. So, you know, there's no strings attached. We just say it because we really do appreciate the continued support that they continue to show Bad Voltage.
Yeah. And just on that note as well, they do offer a genuinely good service as well. I mean, I'm not being paid to say this. Like, I use them personally for my, a bunch of servers that I have. Well, I've got like 3 different VPSs with them, and it's just rock solid. They're a really awesome group of people. So go to a2hosting.com. You can find out more about how to use their stuff.
Badical. That's pure badicalness.
Badical.
Yeah, badical. So that's cool, but what's cooler is having a Bad Voltage app on your phone. Now we've got people working on the iOS, the Android, they got the Ubuntu Touch. I think there is even a teasing one and they're working on it, right? But now we've got Sailfish, right? Now we got a Firefox one officially in the marketplace, thanks to the awesomeness that is Michael Bauer.
Absolutely.
I haven't actually tried this the Firefox app yet, but I bet it's awesome.
I have a Firefox phone and I'm going to give it a try, but I've been busy trying out the new version of the iOS app. The chap making it, L Dude, has gone through 2 revisions in the last week or so, and I'm beta testing it for him. That's awesome. Seems pretty sweet, to be honest with you. I came back with a bunch of feedback and it's all been fixed. It's just great. So at some point that will arrive in an iTunes app store near you.
So we generally point people towards community.badvoltage.org to go and pass their feedback on about the show and get involved in the discussion. But every so often we get some emails as well. And we got an email from friend of the show, as well as friend of Lug Radio as well, Phelim Whiteley, about Firefox OS. It turns out that he was a little annoyed about the review that Ag gave about the Firefox phone. And he said, I foolishly didn't buy a Geeks phone. I actually have the Revolution now, but running Google less Android. But actually went for the only official phone. Utter junk. The phone wasn't badly built, but only had 256 of RAM, 256 meg of RAM. It came with Firefox OS 1. They barely upgraded it, got a 1.1 6 months after it was released, and a half-broken beta of 1.2. Total joke. Okay, so that's the phone builder's fault, ZTE. But that means that the browser is never updated as it's part of the OS.
In one, you couldn't save as.
Oh, that's right, yeah. The email client didn't have push. Okay, fine, but actually, if you change focus, it wouldn't even poll. Then using Twitter, yes, the site of the app, I don't mind that being the same thing, but would constantly crash, likely down to the memory. Firefox is a hog, and 256 meg RAM is just a joke for it. So the 3 things I use a phone for other than SMS and calls, it couldn't do. Pretty poor show. I can see where they're going. I like the idea, but they deliver a crap official experience. The likes of Geeks Phone does it better with the updates and higher versions. Then how can they be applauded? And the browser locked to the OS version is a farce in the day of Firefox updates every couple of weeks. So it sounds like Phelim is basically not very impressed with Firefox OS.
What are you saying there? I think in the review, I mentioned that a lot of the reviews I'd read of Firefox OS were of early versions, which were very, very clearly early betas that didn't work right. The problem is that the Firefox people were that keen on getting a phone on the market that they partnered with ZTE, who put a phone out using one of those early versions, which was possibly, arguably, mistake one. But then certainly, definitely, mistake two was that phone is not able to track newer versions of Firefox OS. You got a phone with a shonky early beta doesn't work right version of Firefox OS, but you can't upgrade it to new versions. Well, I could see why Phelim was annoyed about having this phone, right? Don't get me wrong. I wouldn't necessarily say that's representative of what the Firefox OS experience is meant to be, but it does point to the fact that the Firefox people have to spend more time working with their chosen handset partners or whatever to make sure that when they do a phone, they're not just going to go, oh, we're that desperate to get onto the market that we'll go with anybody and follow any things they come up with. Because if you put a phone out and don't allow it to be upgraded, then a bug is a bug forever and can't be fixed.
And these days, people get really, really mad about that.
Yeah.
Yes.
As you can see.
Yes, indeed.
So moving on to an email from Greg, a.k.a. Old Geek, who is also a regular contributor in the forum, I might add. His email says, hi, guys. I would really like to hear a discussion regarding free software. I heard an interview a while back on the Linux Action Show with Richard Stallman. I think that there could be some good arguments made for the quote-unquote free software only, but Mr. Stallman came across, to me, as a zealot lacking any reason or logic. It seemed as though his position is non-free software is morally wrong because I say so, and that is that. Could both sides of the issue be discussed? Perhaps someone else can be interviewed who would be more balanced in their reasoning. I've never heard Stallman called a zealot before. That is
no.
I love lighting this particular Lunduk touch paper.
Now, I think we should discuss both sides of this issue. We should discuss whether non-free software is a terrible idea just because Stallman thinks so, or whether non-free software is a terrible idea because someone other than Stallman thinks so.
There you go. So what do you think? Should we get Raymond on the show?
No.
Let's bring some balance to this.
Yeah.
No.
We should get a panel with Perrins, Raymond, Stallman, and someone else.
Thunderdome Death Cage match.
Yes. To be honest with you,
the historical footnote panel.
Without wishing to stick the boot too much into someone who is a regular contributor, I'm not sure what a further discussion, even by such wise and noble heads as the four of us, could bring to the idea of whether free software is a good idea or a moral imperative or not. All these discussions were had 30 years ago. Anyone who hasn't already adopted a side is not going to have their position changed by Brian saying free software is the only way forward, or Brian saying free software, it doesn't make any money, it's not the way forward, or however we approach it.
I think it's kind of odd that you're the one saying no one will change their mind, because out of the people I know that had a very strong opinion, you're one of the people that seems to have softened quite seriously on the topic.
Well, yeah, but I don't think anyone who's sending us an email saying I'd like to hear a discussion regarding free software wants to hear about conversion stories from zealot to accepting of proprietary software, right?
They're looking for ways
to convince people to go the other way.
I've actually kind of gone the other way. I used to be, I like free software, but proprietary is fine, make money. And now I'm kind of going more of the free software zealot side of things.
So it's a bit of a timeline for ACK. 2004, no compromise. 2005, no compromise. 2006, no compromise. 2007, no compromise. 2008, compromise. 2009, lots of compromise. 2010, wow, I really like this compromise business going on. 2011, iPhone. 2012,
tiny
iPhone.
Bit harsh,
I love my
perhaps.
iPhone. 2013, I hate free software. 2014, whatever.
2014, app in the iOS store.
I also ought to point out that I'm being criticized here by John O'Bacon, who sold out faster than Metallica in 1994 and never looked back. So I should shut up.
I don't believe I ever said no compromise. I was a sellout from day one.
Exactly, right? You don't get moral bonus points for having sold out right at the beginning. You can't say...
But at least I'm consistent.
Okay, I'm a twat, but I've been consistent about it forever.
He was ahead of the curve on the sellout.
Right? No.
So, Brian, what do you think has caused you to reverse and go the opposite direction?
Because he's a moron.
Yeah, probably because I'm a moron. I'm not really sure. I'd like to say wisdom and old age, but I think Stuart's right. It's probably the moron thing.
Maybe we should. It might be interesting to have a longer discussion about why Brian's going in that direction.
Actually, I would like to have a further discussion, but I think honestly, what kept me away from being free software zealot in the earlier days was people like Richard Stallman that put me off to the concept, whereas I've moved beyond those sorts of people more lately and have then kind of come around to the idea more now.
It might be interesting to think about how the free software argument maybe ought to look in 2014 rather than spending 30 years regurgitating the argument that was true in 1984.
That's actually an interesting idea.
Well, and something like Indie Tech and the Indie Phone plays into that, because that's essentially a rebranding of the word open, of the concept of open source, without mentioning open source and without being involved in the existing open source community, both of which I think might be a good thing.
The The other thing that could mesh into that discussion as well is how you've, I think people's views change over the years as a result of experience and whatever else. Yeah. Like all, I mean, for every single one of us, our views have changed over the years. And it might be because, you know, I think a lot of people, when they first get into free software, like it's a lot of people are very kind of hardcore about it because they're either younger or they haven't got as much experience of the industry or whatever else. And then they tend to balance out a little bit. I think it's the same thing with a lot of things in life. So maybe we should do a segment about that, about our own personal views and how they've changed. And maybe other people can kind of plug into
so,
that.
So community people, idea. We've suggested half a dozen different things we could talk about there, prompted by Old Geek's question. What would you like to hear us talk about? What are you? Yeah, what particular things, what particular aspects of this discussion would you like to see focused on? Go to community.badvoltage.org.
And that brings us to the end of this most triumphant episode of Bad Voltage, where I would like to reiterate, I am once again crowned victorious.
Shut up.
Shut up.
I really enjoy this. Now, if anyone in the community has any ideas for additional competitions that I can win at, feel free to add them to community.badvoltage.org and we'll give them a try, you know? It might be fun, it might not be fun, but either way, the important part is Brian wins.
Absolutely.
Most stupid glasses competition.
Presenter who most annoyed their co-presenters.
Terrible that I was spoiled by aluminium.
Yeah, hair Man. Most like a carpet.
It is a little carpety. It's kind of a crappy carpet, though, to be fair, though.
The good news is that when we are become ultra famous and there is the Lego version of us, they're not going to have to invent a new Lego haircut for you. Plenty in stock.
Lego Bad Voltage. We did it. Make it so, right? Lego people.
Oh, man. Well, they do have those that company that will actually build custom Legos with like your own faces printed on it. Yeah,
really?
you can get minifigs.
I don't know why we haven't done this already.
Built out of that. We could get all of that.
Dude, we need those.
We do need those.
I wonder.
Isn't that a great idea?
I would like to see. I wish we were more famous because I would like to have companies make stuff in our image and send it to us.
Bad Voltage bobblehead dolls would be amazing.
Like bobbleheads.
Oh, man.
Or they could find some random mountain somewhere in America and carve our four faces into it.
Yeah. I'm not sure. We do that shit all the time.
Big enough exists.
Well, do we have anything, guys, that we need people to do for us before next episode? I can't think of anything.
Make us Lego figurines. That's such a good idea. Yeah. Lego minifigs of us. I can't believe I didn't know about this.
That is crazy.
I would like that.
I say we have people go to the thread for the poetry contest and themselves vote, and we'll have a community winner.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Ooh, Miss Congeniality Award.
Good idea.
Here's the thing.
Go and vote.
You guys,
the
within the community, it's just so important that Brian wins that one too. You guys don't understand. It's absolutely critical to the future of Bad Voltage that Brian wins that one. I've just got to put that out there.
All right. Winning two competitions, I could understand as, you know, a minor blip in the space-time continuum. If we have three competitions and Brian wins them all, that's downright embarrassing at that point.
Even a broke clock is correct twice a day, but three times, nah.
Brian stops clock Lunduke.
Suddenly Brian gets kicked off the show. Well, we're sad to announce that Brian Lunduke has gone on to pursue other ambitions.
Oh, that's a sort of a contest win too.
All right, yeah. No, I think we're all good.
So we're good.
So thank you everybody for joining us on the show. Big thank you to, of course, Leslie Hawthorne for being an excellent judge in the poetry competition. And once again, big thanks to A2 Hosting for helping us to have a community.
Absolutely.
Which is at community.badvoltage.org. Yeah. All right. We're signing out. I think that's everything, right?
I think so. As always, thanks
Ciao,
for listening.
Ciao, everybody. Bye. See you in a fortnight.
See ya.